Rochester, New York. This is Democracy Now!
I appeal to the parties. Open the strait. Let ships pass. No tolls. No discrimination. Let trade resume. Let the global economy breathe.
U.S.-Iran talks remain at a standstill as the U.S. is continuing to blockade Iranian ports and Iran has largely halted shipping traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. We'll speak with Jeremy Scahill of Dropsite News. Then the United Arab Emirates has pulled out of OPEC in a move to increase its oil production capacity. We'll look at what the Iran war means for the push to transition away from fossil fuels. And finally, the Supreme Court hears a case that could determine if thousands of cancer patients can sue Roundup's manufacturer, Bayer. We'll speak to Mother Jones reporter Nate Halverson about his new investigation. It's headlined, "We Are Bombarding America's Forests with Roundup."
For decades, Monsanto, the original maker of Roundup, has insisted the product is safe when used as directed. But in 2015, the World Health Organization released a landmark assessment saying glyphosate is probably carcinogenic.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump and his national security team are reportedly skeptical of Iran's proposal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz in exchange for tabling nuclear talks. U.S. officials say President Trump expressed doubts Monday that Iran was acting in good faith. Iran has so far refused Trump's key demand that it end all nuclear enrichment and formally renounce nuclear weapons. In his latest post on Truth Social, Trump threatened Iran to, quote, better get smart soon, unquote. Earlier on Tuesday, Trump posted, quote, Iran has just informed us that they are in a state of collapse. They want us to open the Hormuz Strait as soon as possible as they try to figure out their leadership situation, which I believe they will be able to do, unquote. This is Brigadier General Mohammad Akraminia, a spokesperson for the Iranian army.
Regarding the current situation, we have not considered the war to be over. From the day the fighting stopped and, in effect, a ceasefire or silence took place on the battlefield, since there is no trust in the United States and our enemies, we have continued in the same way as during the war, making serious efforts to update our list of targets.
In southern Lebanon, Israel's killed at least seven people on Tuesday, including emergency workers. It comes as the United Nations reports. Since the start of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, Iranian authorities have executed 21 people and arrested 4,000. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury Department issued a new round of sanctions Tuesday, targeting Iran's banking network and Chinese purchases of Iranian oil. Oil prices continue to rise, with Brent crude reaching $112 a barrel. It comes as the United Arab Emirates announced Tuesday it's withdrawing from OPEC after nearly 60 years of membership. The UAE is the third largest oil producer in OPEC, behind Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Meanwhile, an NBC News analysis found that bets on prediction markets wagering on the war's outcome have now surpassed $2 billion. A federal grand jury has again indicted former FBI Director James Comey, this time over his social media post showing seashells arranged on a beach to read 8647. The two-count indictment claims the image was a death threat against President Trump. Both counts carry a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. The new indictment comes less than a month after Trump dismissed Attorney General Pam Bondi, whom he complained was not aggressive enough in executing his agenda. A previous Justice Department case against Comey was dismissed last year when a federal judge found the prosecutor who secured the indictment had been unlawfully appointed. Comey's second indictment came the same day as his daughter Maureen Comey won a court ruling allowing her to proceed with a lawsuit against the government. Maureen Comey was fired as a federal prosecutor in Manhattan last year. She was the lead federal prosecutor securing the conviction against Epstein co-conspirator Ghislaine Maxwell. James Comey responded to his latest indictment in a video posted to Substack on Tuesday.
I'm still innocent, I'm still not afraid, and I still believe in the independent federal judiciary, so let's go.
The Federal Communications Commission announced Tuesday it's accelerating the review of eight local broadcasting licenses used by ABC. The agency cited an investigation into whether Disney's diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, DEI, constitute unlawful discrimination. The move came one day after President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump publicly demanded ABC fire late-night host Jimmy Kimmel over a joke he made about the First Lady days before the White House Correspondents' Dinner shooting. Democratic FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez said, quote, "This is an unprecedented and politically motivated attempt to interfere with how broadcasters operate, and this unlawful overreach will fail," unquote. The Trump administration's fired all 22 members of the National Science Board, which is the policy and advisory arm of the National Science Foundation. Democratic Congressmember Zoe Lofgren of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology said, quote, "This is the latest stupid move made by a president who continues to harm science and American innovation. Will the president fill the NSB with MAGA loyalists who won't stand up to him as he hands over our leadership in science to our adversaries?" she asked. Last year, the Trump administration targeted the NSF for sweeping cuts under Elon Musk's now defunct Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, halting more than 1,600 NSF grants worth nearly $1 billion. King Charles addressed a joint session of Congress Tuesday. He's only the second British monarch to do so. He reaffirmed what he called the enduring bond between the United States and the United Kingdom and praised NATO while urging continued support for Ukraine.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when NATO invoked Article 5 for the first time and the United Nations Security Council was united in the face of terror, we answered the call together, as our people have done so for more than a century, shoulder to shoulder through two world wars, the Cold War, Afghanistan, and moments that have defined our shared security. Today, Mr. Speaker, that same unyielding resolve is needed for the defense of Ukraine and her most courageous people.
King Charles avoided any mention of the survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's sexual abuse, despite a direct request from Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, who said the British ambassador to the U.S., Christian Turner, had privately told him the king would acknowledge them. King Charles' visit was overshadowed by leaked audio of Ambassador Turner telling a group of British students back in February that the only country that has a special relationship with the United States is Israel. An Israeli court has extended the detention of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of the Kamel Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, again without filing any charges against him. According to Physicians for Human Rights, Dr. Abu Safia is currently held in Negev prison under harsh conditions and is being denied his medication and medical treatment despite a deterioration in his health. Dr. Abu Safia was detained at gunpoint back in 2024 when Israeli forces raided Kamel Adwan Hospital. He had continued working at the hospital even after his son was killed in an Israeli airstrike. UN special rapporteurs have called for Dr. Abu Safia's immediate release, saying they had received reports he has endured severe torture. The Trump administration's issued a new visa restrictions ordering U.S. embassies and consulates to reject applications of foreign nationals who may intend to seek asylum in the United States. The Washington Post reports U.S. officials will be required to question applicants on whether they fear harm and persecution in their home countries. The State Department cable adds, quote, visa applicants must respond verbally with a no for the consular office to continue with visa issuance, unquote. The new rules come after a federal appeals court ruled Trump's claims of an invasion in order to shut down asylum requests at the U.S.-Mexico border is unlawful. The ICE agent who shot and killed Renee Good in Minneapolis is back on duty and has been transferred to a different state, so far facing no consequences after he fatally shot Good in broad daylight back in January. That's according to the Daily Beast, which reports Jonathan Ross is back at work with ICE while the Trump administration continues to sabotage an investigation into Good's killing. At least six senior Justice Department officials quit over the mishandling of the case, as well as an FBI official in Minneapolis who was forced to end an investigation into Ross. In more related news, the state of Arizona sued the Trump administration, seeking to block plans by DHS to turn a warehouse in the city of Surprise into an ICE jail. The warehouse is located across the street from a hazardous chemical storage facility. Democratic Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays filed the federal lawsuit Friday, joining growing opposition nationwide to Trump's expansion of immigrant detention. ICE is also planning to open another jail in Louisiana to detain immigrant children and their families at a former military base and one the nation's most PFAS-contaminated sites. PFAS are known as forever chemicals linked to cancer and other health risks. Meanwhile, a Maryland federal judge temporarily blocked plans to repurpose a warehouse into an ICE detention center as the Trump administration failed to conduct an environmental impact review. The decision could significantly delay Trump's efforts at detaining immigrants at warehouses across the United States. In South Africa, human rights groups are raising alarm as vigilante violence against African immigrants continues across the country. Immigrants say they're living in constant fear, reporting assaults, violent harassment on the streets, and disruptions to their businesses by xenophobic groups. There are mounting calls for the South African government to address the rising threats against immigrants following the reported killing of two nationals from Nigeria. And there are heightened security concerns in Colombia after a series of attacks ahead of next month's presidential election. Armed groups have launched over two dozen drone and explosive attacks since Friday, including a deadly bombing on a highway near Cali, which killed at least 21 people. This is Colombian leftist presidential candidate Iván Cepeda.
It is clear that those behind these terrorist acts are seeking to benefit. Let us say it plainly, the political project of the far right.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman on the road to Rochester, New York. Negotiations between the United States and Iran to end the war are at an impasse as the conflict reaches its 61st day. President Trump and his national security team are reportedly skeptical of Iran's proposal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz in exchange for tabling nuclear talks. U.S. officials say President Trump expressed doubts Monday that Iran was acting in good faith. Iran has so far refused Trump's key demand that it end all nuclear enrichment. The Wall Street Journal reported late Tuesday that Trump has told aides to prepare for an extended blockade of Iranian ports to ramp up the pressure on Tehran. In his latest post on Truth Social, Trump threatened Iran to, quote, better get smart soon. Earlier on Tuesday, Trump wrote, quote, Iran has just informed us that they're in a state of collapse, unquote. They want us to open the Hormuz Strait as soon as possible as they try to figure out their leadership situation, which I believe they will be able to do, President Trump said. This is Brigadier General Mohammad Akraminia, a spokesperson for the Iranian army.
Regarding the current situation, we have not considered the war to be over. From the day the fighting stopped and, in effect, a ceasefire or silence took place on the battlefield, since there is no trust in the United States and our enemies, we have continued in the same way as during the war, making serious efforts to update our list of targets.
And this is U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth speaking at a Pentagon news conference last Friday.
Iran knows that they still have an open window to choose wisely. As we said previously, choose wisely at the negotiating table. All they have to do is abandon a nuclear weapon in meaningful and verifiable ways, or instead they can watch their regime's fragile economic state collapse under the unrelenting pressure of American power.
For more on all of this, we're joined now by DropSite News co-founder Jeremy Scahill. His new piece is headlined, "As Trump's narrative on negotiations flails, Iran is setting its own terms for ending the war." Hi, Jeremy. Can you start off by just explaining the thesis of your piece?
Well, you know, what I've been reporting over the past several weeks is that far from being in disarray, as Trump and his allies in the media have portrayed the Iranian government, it's the Trump administration that is in a state of total chaos, erratic meltdowns that culminated with Trump claiming that J.D. Vance was on an airplane en route to Islamabad to meet the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, then saying that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and special envoy Steve Witkoff, oh, they're actually on the airplane, and they were claiming, oh, the Iranians are begging us to talk, and we're going to go and meet them in Islamabad when Foreign Minister Araghchi is there. The Iranians were telling me, we have no intention of meeting any Americans, and that Iran is on its own tour now of Pakistan, Oman, and Russia, where Araghchi met with President Vladimir Putin, and we're establishing our own terms for ending the war. And so what we've seen here is the construction of a total propaganda narrative that is being repeated by almost every Western news organization, that somehow there are these negotiations going on, that the Iranians are putting proposals in front of the Americans. That's not what's happening at all. What Iran has done is it has briefed Pakistan, which is currently the mediating country in the negotiations between the U.S. and Iran, and they've said to them, here are our conditions for ending the war. And what Iran is saying is, we will enter into direct talks with the United States when President Trump lifts what Iran considers to be the illegal military naval blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. We will have an initial round of discussions about how to facilitate the expansion of commerce and transit through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has maintained that it's not shut down the strait, but that it's just shut it down for any vessels that are linked to the U.S. war in any way. And then after those conditions are met, the Iranians will go back to direct talks having to do with nuclear negotiations. But they're saying that Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are total ignoramuses when it comes to the technical issues in terms of nuclear or other issues, that having Kushner at the table might as well be having Benjamin Netanyahu at the table. That's part of why they pushed for J.D. Vance. Iranians told me that they witnessed during the last round of direct talks a division between J.D. Vance on the one hand and Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff on the other hand. Trump has painted himself into a corner. He's certainly in a quagmire. The administration is desperate to find some form of an off-ramp, and they have been pushing a lie-filled propaganda narrative that has been picked up by media across the board that somehow the Iranians are kind of adjusting their position and coming back to Trump, but it's not good enough yet. The reality is that Trump has no idea how he's going to end this because the Iranians know, or they believe, that they have the three M's on their side: munitions, markets, and the midterms. They think that they have done unprecedented damage to U.S. defensive capabilities in the Persian Gulf. They caused the evacuation of 13 American military bases. They committed widespread damage against American aircraft that only now is starting to come to light. They destroyed the early warning, highly expensive radar systems. The Israelis' interceptors are at dangerous low levels, and the United States is unable to confront Iran's asymmetric posture in the Strait of Hormuz, no matter what Trump does. The markets are in free fall right now, you know, relatively speaking. It's not going to get better. If Trump starts bombing Iran again, they say they're going to hit oil infrastructure in the Persian Gulf, potentially cut undersea internet cables, which would massively disrupt commerce and internet. And the final thing is the midterms coming up. This is a political disaster for Donald Trump. And the Iranians feel like they're in a position that Trump is not holding the cards. And so what they're saying is, if you don't meet our initial demands to lift your illegal naval blockade, we're not going to have any talks with you anytime soon, because you've painted yourself into a corner, and we're going to sit back and let you continue to have less and less space in that corner.
Jeremy, you note that the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, has been on a strategic three-nation tour where he's unequivocally laying out Tehran's position to mediators and key strategic players who may influence future negotiations. You write, quote, Russia played a key role in the 2015 nuclear deal and could emerge as an important guarantor of Tehran's interests in any agreement reached with the U.S. I want to ask you about Russia's role in this, but first, let's go to a clip. This is Russian President Vladimir Putin, followed by the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi in St. Petersburg Monday.
I would like to convey my most sincere words of gratitude and confirm that Russia, same as Iran, intends to continue our strategic relations. We see how courageously and heroically the Iranian people are fighting for their independence and sovereignty. Of course, we very much hope that, based on this courage and will for independence, the Iranian people will, under the leadership of a new leader, make it through this difficult period of trials, and peace will follow. From our side, we will do everything that is in your interest, in the interests of all nations in the region, so that peace is reached as soon as possible. You know our position very well.
I was asked to confirm during this visit that Russian-Iranian relations is a strategic partnership and will remain that way moving forward. It was proven that Iran has friends and allies such as Russia who stand by Iran during difficult times and support Iran. We thank you for your firm position in support of Iran.
So that was the Iranian Foreign Minister Araghchi before that Russian President Putin. Jeremy, talk about what Putin's position is now and back in 2015. It may surprise people.
Right. So back in 2015, when the U.S., with a delegation led by John Kerry, the Secretary of State at the time, spent a year and a half negotiating with the Iranians, and that deal ended with 25,000 pounds of enriched uranium being transferred from Iran to Russia. Now, at that point, the Iranians only had a relatively small quantity of what's called highly enriched uranium, and it was only enriched to a 20% level, and 98% of that highly enriched uranium was shipped to Russia. It's astonishing to think back on it and those numbers, given what we're talking about now, which is roughly 1,000 pounds the Iranians are believed to have of highly enriched uranium, potentially to as high as 60%. And so the Iranians, because of Trump's threatening kind of menacing tone and actions, and certainly because of the 6 weeks of bombing, has said, we're not going to transfer any uranium outside of the country, that it's as sacred to us as our soil, and that we would agree to dilute it so that it could be used for medical and non-military purposes. But transferring it is out of the equation. What's interesting is that I've heard from Iranian sources that if the Iranians felt like they were dealing with normal people on the other end of the table, technical experts and not real estate buddies and the son-in-law of the vice president of the president, but if they were dealing with like an actual technical team as they did back in 2015, that a lot of issues could be on the table. And so part of What may be happening is that the Iranians, on the one hand, want to strengthen their military and political relationship with the Russians. It goes both ways. The Iranians also provide the Russians with drones that are used in the war in Ukraine. The Russians almost certainly have been providing the Iranians with intelligence during the course of the U.S.-Israeli war. But on the other hand, the Iranians are planning a kind of other scenario where, if there is a sane set of discussions on the nuclear issue, would there be some flexibility? I've heard that there are the possibilities that they could consider Russia or even China if they did shift their position, which officially they've given no indication they will. But if that becomes a sort of sticking point and Iran feels that it's getting its own concessions in the form of a widespread lifting of sanctions, a backing off or some kind of non-aggression pact that would certify that the U.S. isn't going to continue this pattern of launching wars in between pretending to be in negotiations with Iran, then the sense that I get is that a lot would be on the table. So I think that the Iranians are also looking at an alternative universe where Donald Trump fabricates some declaration of victory, that he tries to intensify the economic war against Iran in the hopes that they can spark a domestic uprising to bring down the government, and that Trump essentially just, you know, panics himself into a state of saying, like, I'm not going to do this anymore. That's one scenario that could happen. Joe Kent, who resigned as the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, early on after he resigned weeks ago, he came out and said that Trump should essentially do that, kind of walk away. I was told by a senior Iranian official that they think the most likely long-term scenario is that there isn't any major agreement reached and that there is kind of a low-intensity tension that continues to boil. And so, you know, the Iranians feel, though, that time is on their side and that it's Donald Trump who has the clock and that he's watching it with sweat increasingly pouring down his face because Iran has no intention of capitulating. So there's dual tracks that the Iranians are operating on. And I just want to emphasize again that when you read these reports about the Iranians have put a new proposal forward, et cetera, much of what the Iranians have been doing is reiterating their position. They feel that the United States did not understand the significance of what they put on the table back in February, that it would have gone beyond the 2015 nuclear agreement. And I think it's pretty clear at this point that Israel has thoroughly contaminated what the U.S. believes is intelligence on Iran. And it seems quite clear that throughout this war, and actually before it, the Israelis were presenting completely cooked intelligence, that it was going to be easy, that it's going to be a cakewalk, that you just assassinate the leadership and the people are going to rise up. It's not just that Israel has political influence. It's clear that Israel has contaminated the intelligence gathering and presentation to the president of the United States by constantly injecting politicized fake intel to try to keep this war going or to start it in the first place.
On Monday, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said he had become disillusioned with the U.S. and Israel over the war in Iran and said the Trump administration is being outwitted and humiliated. This is Merz.
The Americans clearly have no strategy. And the problem with conflicts like this is always that you don't just have to go in, you also have to get out again. We saw that all too painfully in Afghanistan for 20 years. We saw it in Iraq. An entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership.
Jeremy Scahill, your response.
I mean, on just a factual level, what Chancellor Merz is saying is 100% true. But in real political terms, Merz was a supporter of Donald Trump's actions. Germany, perhaps second only to the United States, has passionately supported and defended the Israeli genocidal operations in Palestine, specifically in Gaza, and these broader wars. And Merz kissed the ring of Donald Trump from the very beginning. He bowed to him and allowed himself to be walked around the block by the Trump world like a poodle. So Merz has no credibility whatsoever. But the fact that even the poodles of the United States, like Friedrich Merz of Germany, the fact that they are saying this openly and saying that the U.S. is being humiliated is a strong indicator of how the sort of game is up. The world realizes that Trump has been lying to manipulate markets, to try to resurrect the oil market situation, to try to pretend as though he's winning because he keeps thinking he's going to bomb the Iranians into submission with his tough boy act on Truth Social. It's not working. And in fact, markets this week even for the first time in this attempt at manipulation, they didn't even react to the bald-faced lie that Trump told yesterday, where he said the Iranians are saying that they're on the verge of collapse and they want Trump to open up the Strait of Hormuz. That didn't happen. And the markets did not react in the way that they typically have to Trump's manipulation every Monday morning. So I think the world is realizing what Mertz, who often is a poodle of the United States, particularly Trump, Mertz is saying the quiet part out loud because it's so obvious that to deny it would make you look like an absolute idiot.
On Saturday, the Iranian Red Crescent Society said it submitted evidence to the International Criminal Court documenting U.S.-Israeli war crimes. The IRCS estimates more than 132,000 civilian structures were bombed across Iran, including hospitals.